And I think what's so hard about the dying process is that we want to hold on so tightly. But similar to birth, there's something so beautiful and heartbreaking about letting someone transition and letting go of their bodies. And
thank you for joining us today. Before we start, we'd love for you to subscribe to our podcast and connect with us on social media. We value your stories as much as our own and are committed to sharing them. Visit our website for more information. All links are provided in the description. In this episode, Kimberly bravely opens up about the devastating loss of her best friend and older sister, Callie. I'm incredibly grateful for her willingness to share, and we hope that by being vulnerable, we can make you feel more understood and supported. Let's dive in.
Welcome back to episode 2 of Nothing Was the Same, a grief podcast. Today, we think it's very important that we spend this episode and next episode kind of giving qualifications as to why we are hosting this podcast. I was talking to someone that's opinion matters very much to me about like my nerves about thinking that I deserve a podcast because everyone has podcasts. And he said, you know, Barack Obama could do a podcast about being president and he's qualified for that. You couldn't, but you know grief. So I feel like this episode, Kimberly is gonna be sharing her grief story, and the next one I'll be sharing specifically about mine, just so that we can kind of share like from the jump what our journey has been and then go into everything after that.
Yeah, let's get right into it. And I think too, to preface, you know, I think what I really want to convey in this episode is the relationship I had with my sister, because, you know, when you lose someone so young, she was 29 when she died and I was 26, that really has impacted my life. Whereas, you know, shortly before she was diagnosed, I lost my grandpa. And my grandpa and I were really close, but I had a different experience with that grief because he was 95 when he died. And so I think through this episode, I really want to explain and just give background as to why my sister and I had the relationship we did and why she was so important to me, and therefore why this loss has impacted me in the way that it has. So yeah, I'm excited to get started.
A little nervous.
I'm a little nervous, if you can't tell my voice.
It's a safe space.
It's a safe space.
I'll be nervous for mine at least.
Yeah.
All right, so why don't you tell us all a little bit about your sister and your relationship too?
Yeah, so I'm the youngest of four girls. We all of our names start with a K. Katie, Carrie, Callie, Kimmy.
So Kardashian of you.
Yeah, except we were from the 90s, so it was like pre-Kardashians. And so Callie and I were definitely very close growing up. My whole family, we're a basketball family. So we grew up, Callie, Carrie, and Katie all played, and I was the baby sister kind of following in all of their footsteps. And throughout high school, you know, I always just was following Callie around and we were on the same team. So really, when I look back on my life and my childhood, she's always been right there, right next to me. And I was considered like her baby sister. Like, she just had such a special spot in her heart for me and I for her. You know, it's so crazy looking back on my life. I always felt this very special softness about my sister, as if there was something different about her. Mm. And when she got sick, it all kind of made sense to me. She just always had this really angelic presence. And not to undermine that she wasn't human and made mistakes and got angry and had bad days, because she definitely did. But if you ask anyone she went to high school with, you know, from popular kids to kids that people didn't know as much, like, they all knew her. She was such a leader, and she was a quiet leader. She was kind to people. She was soft-spoken. You know, people thought she was shy, but mostly with her friends. Like, you know, she had a more outgoing personality. So I think I always had, even though I was the youngest sister, this protectiveness of her. And so when she got sick, that was just amplified. Like, I just, you know, living in New York, she was in Montana, like, being far away from her was really hard. And, you know, throughout her journey fighting cancer, she ended up moving to Arizona, where we're all from. I say this all because I think going through the journey of watching her battle and then, you know, ultimately her losing her battle, it was really hard. And it was hard because I was watching someone that I love so dearly, who's been a leader to me and a big sister to me, ultimately watch her life slip away before her and before all of us. So yeah, I think, you know, talking about her today, like, I really want to honor who she was. Even though she lived a more quiet life, she lived a really big life in a lot of ways.
So even though you were the baby sis, you still felt protective over her?
Oh yeah. And I don't know if it's because I was taller than her, you know, that could play into it. But there, again, it was just this like gentleness about her that I've always felt. For example, with my mom growing up, anytime my mom would cry, like I would feel this angst and want to cry with her. You know, it's like that whole thing, you watch your mom cry and you cry. And with my sister, it was the same. And it wasn't the same with my older two sisters, but anytime she was sad or, you know, we were fighting, I never wanted to be the winner. Like I would win and then I would go back and be like, no, I don't want her upset. I don't want her upset. She can win. She can have it. Like it was just this, I can't even explain it really what it was, but it was just something about her that I always kind of knew she was special. And obviously, you know, she was special and she only was able to live 29 years here, but.
What's the age difference between the four of you?
So the oldest is Katie. She's 4 years, it's Katie, Carrie, they're 4 years apart. And then Carrie and Callie are 2 years apart. And Callie and I are 2 years apart. So between myself and the oldest is 8 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what was your relationship like after moving out of that same house?
So that's a great question because, you know, we were so close throughout high school. We played on the same varsity basketball team. She went to college nearby, so we were still quite close. It wasn't until she moved to Montana to pursue a relationship that we will definitely later on get into in this podcast, because I watched her pursue this relationship that I was never really proud of for her, and I never thought that she was being treated in the way that she should be. So once she moved to Montana, we kind of, not lost touch, but we definitely weren't as close throughout those years. And I was always, again, the youngest sister, but you know, it's my personality maybe. I was always voicing how I really felt about him. And so throughout that process, they ended up getting married. And it wasn't until much later that we had this reunion at her wedding. We really came back and saw eye to eye and we forgave each other. And it was really beautiful. We have a photo of it, of us on the dance floor. And I'm, you know, ugly tears crying and she's crying. But we both looked back on that experience at her wedding as kind of our reconciliation with each other. And crazily enough, she was diagnosed 5 months later after her wedding day.
How old was she when she moved to Montana?
I want to say she had graduated college, so she must have been 23, 24.
Okay. So interesting, yeah. Just because I feel like all of us have friendships, and I don't have sisters, but just relationships where they date someone we don't really like, and you kind of just fall back and let them make their choices, but you just think you have time to come back to each other.
Right. And that's you're right. I wish, you know, obviously it all turned out, you know, I'll share that story another day, but it all turned out that he wasn't good for her. And so I do wish that maybe I could have been more supportive while she was here and was with him. Cause you do, you're right. You think you have more time and you think you're going to have time to have these conversations with the people that you love. And then you realize one day life is short and they mean it. Life is short.
That saying really is true. So tell me about like when she was diagnosed, where were you? What happened?
Yeah. So I was living in New York City. I had just moved. My grandpa had just died the January 5th, and this is January 26th. Wow. So there was not much time in between, and it was on a Monday, and she had a seizure. And, you know, at the time, we didn't know anything because there's a lot of different reasons why someone can have a seizure. And so she was rushed to the hospital, got an MRI, and it showed that there were tumors in her brain. And of course, at the time, you don't know much from an MRI. You can only, you know, it was not until they actually went into surgery. So they went into surgery 5 days later. And I'll never forget it. I was standing in the waiting room.
You were there.
So my whole family flew to Montana to be with her. My parents were there already. I landed, you know, shortly after she got out of surgery. And my father told me in the waiting room after surgery that they found out it was stage 4 glioblastoma brain cancer. Mm. And talk about nothing was the same. You know, the moment that I got the call about her seizure, and that moment, it was like my whole world stopped. And there's so many unknowns and questions and just like, how did we get here? She's 27. She's healthy. She works out all the time. You know, it was just one of those moments where you're just like, how is this real life? How am I living in this? And also Super Bowl weekend. Mm-hmm. So it was Friday night she got surgery, and then Sunday was the game. And even still to this day, Super Bowl is such a trigger for me. She was out of the hospital at that time. She was released, I think, on that Saturday.
But even looking back on that, you know, it was like, she was so, everyone was so anxious to get her out of the hospital. Mm-hmm. And I, as, again, the protective younger sister, I'm like, why can't she just stay? Like, that's where she's going to get the best help. She'll heal. So needless to say, it was a really triggering time for me at that point. And there was just so much that we didn't know.
And then what happened after that? Like, did she start chemo right away?
Yeah, so there was a battle, you know, of where she was going to receive treatment, and she decided she was going to stay in Montana, and so...
Was that like a family battle, or doctor?
It was a little bit of everything. I think we ultimately all just wanted her to have the best treatment and have access to the best treatment, and so she decided that she would receive treatment in Montana, did radiation, chemotherapy, the whole bit. It was super hard on her, mm-hmm. and also she couldn't... drive, and she couldn't be left alone because of the seizures, so she was on a lot of medication. It was just a really, it was a whirlwind of a time for her, especially. That's kind of when the relationship that she was in started to kind of fumble from beneath, because, like I said, she couldn't be left alone, and he started leaving her alone, being out late at night. And so it wasn't until, you know, she went through her rounds of treatment, and then what was it, like 5 months later, she ended up filing for divorce.
So that's like within a year of marriage then, right?
Then a year of marriage. Wow. Then 5 months of being diagnosed with brain cancer.
She filed for divorce.
She filed for divorce, and she moved home to Arizona.
Mm.
Yeah.
And in that year, where were you? Or I guess that 5 months, actually.
Yeah, so I was back in New York. So after she received her, after the initial surgery, we all kind of went back. My dad actually stayed with her, which, you know, looking back, he's just, both of my parents never left my sister's side as much as they could.
But the sisters all went back. And so I went back to New York, and that was a really tough thing for me, because I was willing to get up and go, right? I wanted to move home to Arizona. I wanted to be with her. And she was always so, again, protective of me. I think we just had that special, you know, bond with each other, but she didn't want me to give up my life. She knew how much I loved New York. She knew I had just moved there. You know, I got there like 9 months prior. So she really didn't want me to give up my life there. And I think looking back, had I given up my life, it would have gotten so much more real for her. Mm. But she was really experiencing this, and, you know, we never talked about prognosis. So even the idea that this could be a terminal illness, which it was, I mean, stage 4 glioblastoma, that's what it is, you know. And my family and I, we, maybe people were talking about it, I'm sure they were, but my sister and I just weren't. And so I think the idea of me moving back to home would have amplified that this is a terminal illness and that there will be an end date.
The last thing cancer patients want is stress, right? Like, I feel like I've read that a ton.
Yeah.
And I feel like maybe that, like, terminal feeling might have stressed her out more. Is that kind of the fear?
Yeah, I think, you know, the thing with my sister, because she was more soft-spoken, I think there was a lot that she battled behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. She had a really amazing dog. Shout out to Riley. and he's actually still living in with my parents. But, you know, I think there was a lot that she battled with him, and had, he was her emotional support. And looking back, I wish I had more conversations. I wish I had been more courageous to say, listen, like, let's talk about this, you know. But out of respect for her, out of my own fears, out of, you know, such a vulnerable thing to talk about. So there were many times where she and I just had this safety together, that when we were together, it wasn't about cancer.
Mm, that's nice.
Yeah. So.
And so how... did she, I don't know how to speak about cancer, so I'm sorry.
No.
Was there a point after she got divorced, moved back to Arizona, where she was cancer-free, or?
There were a few different moments. So how it worked for her, she'd go, you know, she'd do her treatment, and then she'd get an MRI and get her checkups. And there were, I want to say even 3 times where she got her MRIs, the tumors were shrinking, like, there were celebrations, you know, and... Mm. There was a lot of hope in those moments. And again, because we didn't have these conversations about prognosis, these celebrations would happen, these big moments and milestones in her healing journey. And I'm like, oh yeah, of course she's not dying. She's right. got this.
Yeah.
You know, and that's all she wanted people to think was that she had it. You know, there's this, the book Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, and he talks about if you have a will to live, you can get through anything. Mm. And I really think my sister had an extremely strong will to live, which I think, you know, if you do any Google researching on glioblastoma, which I don't recommend anyone do, it's very uncommon for someone to battle for 27 months. It's a really long time for someone to fight.
What is the normal?
I didn't do much Googling, but I know it's much less.
You know, really?
It's just a much more, it's a really severe, aggressive brain cancer. And so for my sister to battle for 27 months, it said a lot just about, I think, her attitude. And, you know, again, every case of cancer is different. So I don't want to speak to like the masses of cancer, but for her, she really went through it, but she really fought hard.
Yeah. And so was there like when, right before she passed, was she in chemo again? How was her health?
Her health was honestly, she worked out throughout her journey.
Wow.
Yeah, she was always at the gym.
She liked strength training or what?
She loved strength training. Yeah, she loved lifting weights. She was just a strong person. She was a strong individual. She had a really resilient spirit. She would always take Riley out for walks and to throw the ball, which is his favorite thing to do. She really lived well throughout her time. There were moments where the chemo would really get her down. It made her really nauseous at times. You know, there were points in her journey where she was really low. But for the most part, looking back, like there were, you know, we were always sharing memes together throughout. We were always texting. There was still so much lightheartedness with her, which I always admired because obviously what she was up against was extremely difficult. Yeah.
Yeah. So she's so healthy. She's working out every day, walking Riley. And what happened?
I mean, that's the question we all still really are left with, because once she moved to Arizona, she was receiving top care treatment. Her doctors were amazing. The nurses were amazing. She was getting the best care. She was actually up for an immunotherapy trial in LA that she was able to get, which is, if anyone in the cancer world knows, trials are extremely hard to be accepted into.
I've seen Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah. See? Callie loved Grey's Anatomy.
Oh, really?
Me, not so much. Cannot watch Grey's Anatomy. Don't have the stomach for it. But yeah, so trials, she got into this amazing trial at Cedars-Sinai in LA, which we all were here for. We all flew out for and drove out for. And, you know, even looking back on that, like we had family dinner and at the restaurant that I can't even go back to and won't go back to ever to probably in LA. But it was a really beautiful time as a family because, you know, we were staying out in Manhattan Beach. That work helped, like everybody in that time in my life too really stepped up to the plate to support me and therefore to support her and my family. And she signed up for this trial. She went on, you know, underwent another brain surgery. And, you know, this podcast, we're sharing it, right? But in the morning that she was going in for surgery, she wanted me, and again, my parents, I'm like, sorry if you're listening, but she wanted me to be rolled back with her for the beginning of the surgery. And that just, I think, went to show our bond and how close we were and just being able to hold that time for her. I mean, I can't even imagine that what she was going through at that time, being wheeled back for a brain surgery. And my parents ended up, I did not win that fight. My parents ended up going back
really?
With her. Yeah, I wasn't able to go in.
So she requested you and your parents were like,
yeah, that's not
no.
Nice try, youngest sister, you are not going back. Mm. So she went back for surgery and, you know, it was, looking back at that time, it was really, really hard because she was recovering well from the surgery. And it wasn't until, you know, she was in the normal room, she wasn't in ICU, and it was probably like 3 days in, she was about to get released, and my mom, my dad, and I were all in the room with her. And this nurse was in there. And I don't know what triggered her, but when this nurse was near her, I don't know if it was a smell or whatnot, if it was cigarette smell, I'm not really sure what happened, but something happened and she had a seizure. Mm. And it was mayhem. And it's one of the moments that I've had to heal and work on PTSD from, because it was so traumatic. I was in the room. My parents were in the room. You know, they were calling all of these things on the sirens in the hospital, and they were, you know, because it was just, I can recall being back in that room. And so that was the moment where she got moved back into ICU. And it was so crazy. I mean, my mom ended up leaving the room. She passed out down the hall. Mm. So then when this was all happening, they called my dad to go check on my mom. Mm. My mom was admitted to the ER in the hospital.
Oh my gosh.
So they took her away. My dad went with her. I stayed with Callie, and she had to go get another MRI once they were able to stable her. So I stayed with her and waited outside the MRI room. And she eventually went back. She was transferred back into ICU and was there for quite a while. I want to say maybe a week. And, you know, she was finally released from LA, went back to Arizona, and that was all in February. So in March, middle of March, or late, you know, March 25th, I think it was, she was doing well, like, you know, healing from this big surgery, back at home. And at night, my parents were, you know, they were having a conversation with her at dinner, and things started to not make sense. And they were asking her questions, and she was kind of spacing out, and it was turning out that she was having seizures. So they called the ambulance, they came for her, and that was when nothing was the same after that point. She was admitted, and in order to contain the seizures, they put her in an induced coma, and that was a Saturday night. And that next Sunday, she was gone. Mm. And it turns out that for whatever reason, you know, which we still are wondering about from a medical perspective, there were tumors. It was like her brain exploded with tumors. And it just, something happened. And she ended up not responding to the immunotherapy. And yeah, we lost her. Mm. But from that moment of, you know, she was like shopping at the grocery store with my grandma that weekend. Like, she was so out in the world until she wasn't. Mm. So it happened really quickly.
It still felt sudden.
It felt sudden, exactly, because she was healing. You know, we were so used to this cycle of receiving treatment, the tumor shrinking, her gaining some more freedom, you know, and then all of a sudden, that's what we thought was going to happen this time too. And she was in the hospital and never came back out. Mm. Yeah.
So were you all in the hospital when she passed, or did the whole family fly in, or?
Everyone was there. We had about a week to say goodbye, so we kind of took our time with it. She was, you know, in the coma, and the process was just slow. But it turned out, you know, she died on a Sunday. It was that Thursday that we got the results back from her MRI that there were tumors everywhere. She was admitted to hospice. I remember being at my grandparents at the time, obviously just me and my grandma. She made me a peanut butter and jelly. Mm. And we got the call that hospice was, you know, there and whatnot. So at that point, you know, after the week we all had together, Sunday, we kind of knew it was going to be the day. And,
oh, okay.
Yeah, and so, you know, April 1st was that Saturday. It was her full day. And at this point, you know, she wasn't responding. She was just there. But there are moments that week that were still really special. And one of them I've shared with you before about sitting outside under a tree on that Tuesday, the week that she was in the coma, and someone out of nowhere walked up to me and handed me a poem that said, "Do not quit." Mm. And I still, to this day, from, I don't know if it's a spiritual woo-woo perspective, but I really don't feel like my sister was in her body experiencing all of this. I think when this happens, she was, quote, you know, for lack of better words, saved from it. You know, she was there, but wasn't experiencing the pain of her body. And I really wanted to feel that connection to her, to know that that was true. Mm-hmm. and I had just asked her for a sign. And it was at that moment that this woman appeared with this poem. I still have it to this day. And, you know, it's the do not quit poem. When things get hard, don't quit, don't give up. And I knew it was my sister. Mm. And I knew that she was with me and that she was okay and that I can just trust this process of the end. And I think what's so hard about the dying process is that we want to hold on so tightly. But similar to birth, there's something so beautiful and heartbreaking about letting someone transition and letting go of their bodies. And so for me, what I wanted to do that week was just really be present the best I could. I wanted to be just there for my family. I wanted to be there for my sister. I wanted her to know that I would be okay, even though I absolutely wasn't going to be okay, you know? And that day, that Sunday, when it was her last day, I just saw my dad really struggling, of course. And so I told him, I had this like feeling overcome me that my sister played basketball so hard growing up, so hard to the point where she would get sick and throw up from just like total exhaustion from playing. And I had told my dad in the hospital room, I said, she's just played such a hard game. Like, we have to let her sit down. And I think it helped him, but it also helped me put that in perspective, because here's this girl, she's 29. She had her whole life ahead of her. She gave it everything she could, you know, and we had to let go. Like, we couldn't keep her in this body anymore that was just deteriorating, and she lost so much of her freedoms. I remember one of the last texts she sent to me, she's like, you'll never know how much I just wanted to pee alone. I wanted to go to the bathroom alone. Like, I just wanted these simple things back. And that wasn't the Callie that we all knew and loved, that was like, you know, couldn't be alone, couldn't drive, had to rely on everyone. No, she was so independent and happy and lived such an active lifestyle that this wasn't the life for her anymore. And so as hard as it was for us as her family and the people who love her most to watch her go, like, that was the only choice we were left with. Like, we can't keep holding on. You know, she doesn't want to live like this. And so I think in the dying process, from what I learned from that, is like, just to be able to respect someone's process and letting them know, either energetically or by telling them, like, it's okay to go, you know. And I think I look back on that time and it just feels out of body. I remember people I called in the hospital right after that, you know, two of my closest friends. I remember where we went to dinner after, but like, how could any of us eat? I remember the next day just sitting by the pool outside in my family's backyard, just wanted everything to just like disappear. And, you know, I think that part in the process of my sister's journey was just, the end was just something I will always grapple with and never really totally have peace with, I think. But it, through time, I've been able to sit with it more. You know, in the grief process, this is what has made everything feel so difficult. And there's so much in my grief journey that I'm left with questions, and I don't understand how someone so healthy could become so sick, and this person that I envisioned that would be with me for the rest of my life is gone now. And there's so many moments that I have, I'm like, where is she? I just don't understand where she is. And throughout going through all the grief stages, you know, it took me a really long time to get to the acceptance stage. It wasn't until I started working with a therapist that they were like, you haven't even, this has been what, 4 years, 5 years, and you haven't even accepted this loss. I'm like, what are you talking about? And they're like, you're stuck. You can't accept that it happened to her. And yeah, when things go wrong and she's so young and this doesn't make sense, and how could this happen? How could she have died when she was so convinced that she was going to live? And how did this, why did the trial not work and what went wrong and, you know, just making sense of it all. And the relationship she had, I had to do so much work about that because it required a lot of forgiveness, because I didn't want my grief journey to be tied into what went wrong in her relationship. I wanted the focus to be about her life and the good parts about it. And so throughout, you know, to your point about being qualified to speak on grief, like I have lived in the trenches for 7 years of despair in so many alone moments. Mm-hmm. And I've carried on. I went back to work, lived in New York City, would go out, drink socially. Like there's so much of my life. I look back on these 7 years and I'm like, oh, everyone must have thought I was fine. Mm-hmm. And there's only very few people in my life who know just how bad it was so often, you know, in these moments of I'd go out and drink and then just absolutely lose it emotionally because mm-hmm. there was so much I wasn't able to process because it was a lot to process. Yeah. You know, like how do you process the unprocessable? Mm-hmm. I don't think that's a word. I just made it up. But it's like how do you make sense of something that you can't make sense out of? Mm-hmm. And you're just left with these pieces and you're like, how do I put this puzzle together? It's never going to fit the same.
Yeah.
So much of the journey, because of this person was so close to me and I so close to her, how do I move forward in a meaningful way and just being able to carry on?
Well, that's what we're here for, I guess. That's what this podcast is about, is that part.
Yeah, the hard part.
Anyone, you, me, and anyone who's listening has gone through all of our unique traumatic journeys, whether it's 27 months or really 1 week. Mm-hmm. Or for me, a Saturday night.
Yeah.
That part is not the easiest part, but that we have no control over, but it's mm-hmm. the figuring out how to keep going forward that I feel mm-hmm. like is the meat of the conversations we'll be having.
Yeah. Thank you for this conversation. I think, you know, this has been a really tough conversation to have, and it's hard because there's so much that you want to share, but, you know, it's also a really vulnerable thing to talk about. Mm-hmm. And even here, you've invited me to have this conversation and I'm still like, well, I don't want to talk about these hard parts. I don't want to put too much on you. I don't want it to be too heavy. And I think even that is like, this is exactly to your point, what we're here for mm-hmm. is like, if not now, then when are we going to have these conversations? And, you know, opening up this can of worms of grief, it's like, yeah, this is hard, but it's not, like, it's not there. Mm-hmm. We're just talking about what is already there.
Yeah. And I think, listen, you and I could talk about our personal grief journeys for 10 hours
yeah.
every day.
Yeah.
But that's what we have a whole podcast
yeah,
for.
Exactly.
But that's I feel like for. That was a really vulnerable way to kind of walk us through
yeah.
how you became someone who's living with grief. And I thank you for sharing that with me and with
yeah.
whoever, if anyone other than our parents listens.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you.